Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about Alexei Navalny, the opposition politician and anti-corruption activist who was Russian President Vladimir Putin's most outspoken foe for more than a decade. Like a growing number of Russians who have stood in Putin's way, challenged his rule, or attracted attention by presenting a vision of a Russia that is different from the one Putin has shaped over nearly a quarter century in power, Navalny is no more. He died in a prison north of the Arctic Circle on February 16th, at the age of 47. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is one of the people who literally wrote the book on Navalny. He is Jan Mati Dalbaum, a research group leader at LMU Munich and a co-author with Benjamin Noble and Morvan Laouet of the book Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. Thanks very much for joining me, Jan.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the program, Steve.
All right. I appreciate it. Great to have you on the show again, though the occasion is, of course, extremely grim. The last time you were my guest was last August, when Navalny had just been sentenced to 19 years in prison after a trial on extremism charges. Like other charges in the past, Navalny and his supporters and many people who have followed his nonviolent activism for years dismissed these as absurd and politically motivated. I'm just going to mention one thing. In the intro, I mentioned, you know, his death. He died in an Arctic prison. The circumstance, I'll just go into the circumstances a little bit. Very murky. He seemed fine. I mean, he's been mistreated for years in prison, but he seemed okay the day before, and I guess the previous day as well. The day before his death. And the Russian authorities so far have refused to release, to hand over his body to his relatives, and they have not given a suspected cause of death, as far as I know. So, a lot of concern and mystery and suspicion surrounding his death in prison. Now, I usually ask the guests two questions on this podcast, and this time I'm going to cheat a little by asking two-part questions. I'll preface the first by going back to January 2021, when Navalny returned to Russia from Germany, where he'd been recovering after a near-fatal nerve agent poisoning, which occurred in Siberia, and which he blamed on Putin and the Federal Security Service, the FSB. Navalny was detained at the airport upon his return, and he had been in state custody. At the time of his death, he had been in state custody in increasingly harsh jails and prisons ever since. A month after his return, I wrote an article that asked whether his decision to come back to Russia was a masterstroke or a mistake. And I said that it was months or years too early to tell. Now, 3 years later, Navalny is dead, and Putin is sure to secure a new six-year term in the Kremlin next month. Jan, here's my two-part question. This part may sound a little strange, but was Navalny's return a mistake? Obviously, it was a decision that ended up costing him his life. And was he doomed to die an untimely death when he stepped off the plane at Sheremetyevo Airport in 2021?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Steve. I think it would be interesting first to look at this two-part question from Navalny's own perspective. So, I mean, of course, I don't know his thoughts, but I know what he's said all the time, what his colleagues have said, what his wife has also recently again repeated. And so let's look at that. For starters, And so if we ask ourselves the question, was his decision to return a mistake, then that assumes that he really had a choice, right? So that there were alternatives for him, among which he then picked one, and that one was to return, right? So, but he's always been saying that there were no such alternatives for him. Of course, technically, that would have been possible, but it wasn't apparently, a serious alternative that he even considered. Now, I'm going to talk about what might be the strategic point behind this, right? And also behind this message that he's been putting out. But let's take this seriously for a moment. Maybe it actually was the truth, right? So that he had this very strong urge to get back to Russia as soon as it was physically possible for him. And that meant that he had to recover, of course, but he didn't even finalize his recovery. So he was still weak from the poisoning that had occurred a few months earlier. And he returned at the earliest moment that it was physically possible for him because, as you said, that was his only choice and that was his only possibility. Seeing himself as a Russian politician who couldn't really affect things outside of Russia because that would have made him a dissident, or somebody who just watches things from the sidelines rather than participating in them directly, even if that participation meant that most likely, and he probably viewed that very clearly, he would end up in prison. But that was something that he then just accepted as a price for being able to be in Russia. And I would actually believe that. I think there were, of course, strategic thoughts behind that decision as well. Strategic sounds a bit,
calculated.
Yes, exactly. So, what I mean is that he wanted to send a signal also. It wasn't just, his inner urge to return because he sees himself as a Russian politician, but also he wanted to send a signal to his supporters and to Russian society in general that you don't have to be afraid of your actions. And if you really want to do something and if you really mean what you do and if you really stand for something, then you should do it. Even if that means that you're going to pay a price. Of course, he wasn't expecting the same kind of sacrifice from his supporters, but he wanted, I think, to send a signal to them that if he can endure what he's going to endure in prison, then they can probably endure, or he wanted to help them endure their own situation in which they are and send a signal of hope and courage to them. And also to show that he's not afraid of the Russian regime. And while he was in the court proceedings, we always saw him in these videos when he made his statements. He was joking about the authorities even while they were completely physically dominating him, thereby sending also the signal that he cannot be dominated morally, right? And that decision was also sending that signal, right? So you can ask whether it was a mistake, and of course it was looking from mainly the physical aspect of it, and it was something that not many other people would have done, but maybe it was actually the case that he didn't have a different choice, and it was also for him probably the right decision even if he had a different choice, because it was a very powerful gesture to send signals of hope and courage. And of course, the second part, he did die an untimely death, definitely. But again, the question is, was there an alternative to that decision? I think another factor might have played a role, and that is he definitely accepted a prison term, but he probably didn't know that it was going to be that long and that harsh of a prison term. Because even early 2021, it was a different Russia than it is today, right? So he was, after all, returning thinking that he was probably going to be locked up, but for a violation of his parole conditions. And that was the first sentence that he received, right? It was something right. like 2.5 years or 3 years or something. And there was this Instagram post that recently resurfaced where he compared that prison term to a journey into the cosmos, right? In the tradition of the Russian cosmonauts. And he said, maybe it's even going to take 3 years, right? And that was exactly the term that he was convicted for first, or that he received first. But then, of course, the whole repression took another turn. And over the year 2021, this complete destruction of his organization took place. We also talked about that in the last episode. This extremism case then developed, and he received, first he received another 9 years, and then he received from this extremism case another like 19 years. And so all of this additional repression and this him making him a real political prisoner rather than, you know, someone who's convicted of some fraud case, right? That just happened in 2021 while he was already in prison in Russia. And it was probably part of the preparation for Russia's war against Ukraine to completely clean the space from any sort of organization that would have been able to build some sort of resistance against the war. And but Navalny probably didn't foresee that, right? When he returned, he probably thought he was going to end up in prison, but probably not for the rest of his life. And so there was also that element to it. And had he known that, we don't know what the calculation would have been. But I actually think that it's possible, at least if not likely, that even that wouldn't have stopped him from going back to Russia.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good question, but I tend to agree because, I mean, as you say, when he did return, there was only one, you know, it was pretty clear that they were going to arrest him. Mm-hmm. And I think it was somewhat clear, you know, as I think you suggested, that he would be imprisoned for, I think it ended up being 2.5 years. At first, it was 3.5 for this parole violation, which was kind of an absurd thing because he violated parole by being poisoned and, you know, going to Germany to be treated. But this was the only conviction against him or case that was sort of. Known about. I think there had been threats of further prosecutions, but at the time, and the other thing you also mentioned, this was 13 months before the invasion of Ukraine, and it was before, I guess, the first military buildup in the spring, shortly after Russian buildup of forces at the Ukrainian border shortly after Navalny's return and arrest, and then the huge buildup in the fall that preceded the invasion in February. So, you know, there were not, he could not have known that this was going to happen, even though, as you say, presumably his arrest and in particular the increasing prosecutions against him were part of a, you know, a move towards the invasion of Ukraine. Another thing I would say is, you know, I think you mentioned his, you know, the signals that he sent by returning. And I do think, quite a few people in the opposition, criticized him for returning or said, you know, it was the wrong move. But, you know, the signal that it sent, and I think many who, even some who criticized him probably acknowledge that the signal is very strong. And it really is, to return, you know, it's such a difference being in Russia and not. And two other opposition leaders, Vladimir Karamurza and Ilya Yashin, have also returned since then and have also been imprisoned. I believe that's the case with Yashin, actually. I'm not sure right now. Raises the question or underlines the challenge that's now faced by Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya, who has vowed to continue his work, to continue his activism. But she is abroad in Germany, and you know, that's one of the big challenges she faces. My second question, thanks very much for that, Jan. My second question also has two parts, but I'll get to it much more quickly, or I'll try to. Jan, you've co-authored a book about Navalny, studied him, spoken to many of his allies. I'd be interested in your impression of Alexei Navalny, and apologies for asking you to predict what's to come, but your thoughts about what his legacy may look like. The title of your book asks whether Navalny could be Russia's future. There's a question mark on that part of the title. Is that still possible despite his death?
Right. So on the impression, I can most authoritatively speak, if you will, about the impression that his supporters left on me, and I'm not talking about the FBK, the organization that he was leading, but more the supporters on the ground that I was talking to, many of those in the Russian regions in 2017, 2018, when Navalny was conducting his presidential campaign. So, I mean, it wasn't really a presidential campaign. It was styled like a presidential campaign. If the listeners will probably remember that, very openly styled like U.S. presidential campaigns, with the small but significant difference that he wasn't a candidate yet, right? So he was campaigning to gather signatures to be eventually registered as a candidate. But he wasn't registered as a candidate after all, which was quite predictable.
Right, he was denied yes. registration. He was barred from the ballot. Yeah. But as you say, there had already been, you know, he had already been campaigning for some time.
Exactly. Yeah. So that decision was, I think, in December 2017, and the campaign had been running for the whole preceding year. So he was touring the country in 2017, and opening his regional offices, these shtabi, as they called them, in almost every region of Russia. And I was doing my fieldwork for my PhD at that time. And so I was researching something related, but not entirely the same thing. So I was looking at the legacies of the 2011-12 protest wave. That was, you know, one of the first probably experiences of political action and protest for many people in the Russian regions for quite some time. And I was interested in understanding what kind of legacies that protest had left in the Russian regions a few years after that. So I was going or touring the regions as well, sort of in parallel to Navalny a little bit. So the campaign was in full swing by then, and I took the chance to not just speak to those who protested in 2011-12 and ask them what they had done after and what kind of organizations they'd been building, but also talking to Navalny's activists or those who were organizing the protest events and working in these shtabi, in these regional offices. Sometimes, of course, these were the same people, right? So some people had been protesting for the first time in 2011-12, and then might have been a little disappointed, perhaps, by the fact that those protests back then weren't really were often dominated by people who were active or had been active since the perestroika times. So the really the protest veterans, and sometimes there had also been conflicts with that sort of earlier generation, and then Navalny's campaign was a way for them to to participate more permanently on a more permanent basis, and to do their activism in a different and slightly more modern way. So Navalny's offices there were really I was in Perm, in Yekaterinburg, in Saratov, in Rostov on Don, in Volgograd, in Samara, and I talked to Navalny's activists in all of these places, also in Krasnodar and in the south, and in all of these places was really, so these are very different cities, obviously, with very different local civil society structures, but in all of these places, the Navalny offices were really new hubs for activists together to plan also local politics. To in Perm, for example, even though Perm is of course a city with, or was at least a city with a very strong, very diverse civil society from the 1990s or the 80s even. Even there, it was kind of a new impulse, and it quickly became a center for people from also very different political outlooks to gather and to plan, not just planning getting Navalny on the ballot. That was sort of course the idea behind the campaign, but also using that as a place for many other initiatives, be they ecological protests or judicial help for individuals who have been in conflict with the state in one way or the other. So those were really new and actually pretty uniting centers of civic action. And so Navalny has sometimes been described as this. A bit of a sectarian person who's gathering a following for himself and is not really ready to cooperate with other opposition forces. That has been a sort of a continuing accusation, and that is partly probably was true, given the fact that he was really discussing a lot with other people from the opposition, especially on social media, and not always in very friendly terms, and clearly he and his organization sort of wanted to be the leaders of the whole movement, and not everybody was happy with that. But in the regions, the picture was really different, I think. So in the regions, those Shtabi were really more uniting than they were dividing, because. I mean, it's a very different thing, I think, to be an activist in Volgograd than to be an activist in Moscow, right? So they were just forced, I think, partly at least, forced by the circumstances to work together much, much more closely in the regions, and to just leave behind all of those accusations and rhetorics on the federal level. So my impression really was that his campaign was very, very important for bringing people together and for giving them hope in an abstract way, but also giving them experience of collective action and of a spirit to be able to do something together, to have plans and dreams and hopes about what Russia can be, even in their local surroundings, right? And I think so to me, that was the most impressive and positive element of Navalny's politics and his campaign. Of course, I know I'm not talking representatively here, and I'm talking much more about the regional aspect than about the federal one. But that's the impression that I feel most confident talking about. And I think it may also be the most important for the future, actually. So if you're asking about the future, that I think is really an important legacy that Navalny is leaving behind, regardless of what the short term will bring, and the short term is probably going to be very depressing. I mean, the news of Navalny's death, I think, sent people in the opposition, but probably more broadly, into even deeper despair and hopelessness. I mean, of course, we shouldn't forget that many Russians simply don't know about this, and even if they know, they don't care, right? So that we shouldn't think that this news now send all of Russia into despair. Of course not. And one might say, unfortunately not. Unfortunately, probably too few people care about this. But those who do care, I think there's very little hope right now. On the other hand, and we know that from social movement theory, they even have fancy words for that. Some call it abeyance, for a movement to be able to just hold out for years or even decades. Because the people know that when the time comes, they can regroup, they can find their old friends and acquaintances, they can reactivate their old networks. Because they did it all before, and so rebuilding is going to be much easier than building from the ground up, right? So once there will be the conditions for new activism, new politics in Russia, and at some point the change will come. I mean, that is just the law of history. The question is just when. When the time comes, then it will be possible to just remember the things that they did. For example, during Navalny's campaign, remember the people they worked together with, and hopefully start something new. And maybe that will even resemble this wonderful Russia of the future that Navalny has been trying to build. And so, of course, we don't know when that happens, but we know that at some point there will be the possibility for it to happen. And I'm quite confident, even though it's very dark right now, I'm quite confident that the experience of collective action that so many people have received, also thanks to Navalny, that will be a tremendous help in the future.
All right, Jan. You know, I could comment and try to build on that, but I really think and it was a fascinating account, you know, of your time, you know, meeting with, talking to these people in Navalny's network. So I'm really just gonna leave it at that. I think it's a very, very interesting comments about the legacy and kind of I guess unexpected for me in the way that. You're talking about this kind of local action and building things and how this could survive even through years of the times that Russia is going through now. So thanks very much. We're going to wrap it up there. And I really appreciate your joining me, Jan.
Yeah, thanks, Steve, for having me.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Jan Mati Dolbaum, a research group leader at LMU Munich and co-author of the book Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFARL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.